It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
One, the co-anchor of America's Newsroom, the co-host of The Five, Dana Perino, will be right here today on The Will Cain Show. Two, 5 things you need to know at the opening of the trial against Donald Trump. And three, I think that I've hit the bottom. Not the bottom of the internet, but I've hit the bottom of Netflix, of Amazon Prime, of Paramount, of Peacock. I've hit the bottom. I've seen everything. There's nothing left to watch. Coming up on The Will Cain Show. It is The Will Cain Show, streaming live at FoxNews.com, on the Fox News YouTube channel, the Fox News Facebook page, always on demand wherever you get your audio entertainment, at Apple, Spotify, or at Fox News Podcast. Just hit subscribe, and hit subscribe on YouTube at the text description right under this live stream. And then you can get it whenever you want. Just subscribe to The Will Cain Show. From the jury to the testimony to the opening statements. Coming up a little bit later, I'm going to break down the 5 things you need to know going into this trial against Donald Trump. But this weekend on Fox and Friends, a perhaps much more important debate broke out with the White House, a former White House press secretary. It is not my guest today on The Will Cain Show. It is not Dana Perino. It was Kayleigh McEnany, who was guest hosting Fox and Friends Weekend. And this came up, and we realized there might be a gender divide. There might just be a huge debate in America. Do you eat in the bed? Watch.
Finally, eating in bed is becoming an increasingly popular trend among young people.
Gross.
Why not?
Oh, yeah. Are you serious, Kayleigh?
Yes. Let's get... My daughter and I do it all the time.
All right, we're going to get to that in a moment. Data from a new survey shows 58% of Americans between 18 and 24 say their bed is their preferred place to eat when they get hungry late at night, while nearly 44% of adults of all ages admit to doing the same. So we want to know, do you like to eat where you sleep? Or is snacking in the sack a no-go? Email us friends@foxnews.com. The more colorful and descriptive, the better.
Okay, here's my, first of all, never saw that one coming, Kayleigh.
I didn't see this coming.
Well, I'm going to bet this is one of the places you and I are on the same side. This is a no-no.
Big time.
Yeah.
Why? What?
This is gross.
It's gross. And then if you do it, then your kids do it. And then there's stuff in your sheets. It's just gross. Hey, just get up
Crumbs
and eat over here.
In your sheets.
My husband, Sean, agrees with you. And when he goes out of town on hunting trips, my daughter, Blake, and I mean, we lap it up.
There it
is. We bring, like, cake to bed, ice cream,
cake
and crumbs everywhere. Yes. And she's 4, so you can imagine how this turns out.
I don't even like it on the couch.
All right. Is this a male and female thing? Is this a former White House press secretary thing? Let's settle this debate here in America with story number one. She is the co-anchor of America's Newsroom, the co-host of The Five. She is also the host of Perino on Politics right here at Fox News Podcast, and the author of Everything Will Be Okay. It is the former press secretary for George W. Bush, Dana Perino.
Hi, how are you?
Do you eat in the bed?
Never.
It's
no.
Unacceptable.
I wonder, I don't know if it's gender. I wonder if it's age. I'm so much older. I don't know. She's so young and so accomplished, and she has children. So maybe that's why, but no, I don't. But my dog is on the bed.
Does your dog sleep in the bed with you?
I made a mistake when he was a little puppy. He had gotten sick. So I had Jasper, who, like, he was a famous dog. I loved him so much. And when he was 9, he died. And it was sudden. It was shocking. It was horrible. 10 weeks later, we got this new puppy, Percy. And in the first, 2 weeks we had him, he ate some mulch. I didn't know he had eaten mulch. And I found him with, drool, bloated belly. Like, we had to rush him to the emergency room. And thankfully, it was going through the system, and he was going to be okay. But it was so traumatic for me. And that night when we got home, I said to Peter, I know I'm making a huge mistake here, but I don't want to worry that he's not breathing at this tonight. I want to be able to, so I'm going to let him sleep in the bed. And he said, you know what you're doing, right? I said, yep. 6 months later, try to kick him out of the bed. Did not work. I mean, it was the most, it's a disgust. He lost it being kicked out of the bed, like explosive, you know what? Like it was horrible. At 4 a.m., we gave in and said, okay, fine. So now the dog's on the bed, which most people might think is gross.
I think it's a mistake.
It is a mistake.
You did, in your story about Jasper and Percy, I think you did something, you made a mistake, but you also did something smart. So here's what you did smart. So I don't think you know I've talked about this. I had a dog that I got when I was 21. I was a senior in college. He was my right-hand man. Mm-hmm. I mean, everywhere I went. I took him to college parties. Mm-hmm. He was a Doberman, black and tan. Mm-hmm. And he was so smart. He would sit next to me, stand next to me at the party. He may take a lap, but he'd always come back to me. I mean, I literally didn't go anywhere without this dog. Mm-hmm. When he died, in the interim, by the way, I acquired a wife, I had kids, and so he became part of a family. But when he died, I was like, there's no replacing this dog, and I cannot do it. So I waited 10 years until I got another dog, which I got another Doberman, female. She's fawn colored. She's very different than him.
She must look like Percy.
She looks like a little bit like a Weimaraner.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
She's grayish. Mm-hmm. But I waited way too long, Dana. You were smart to get Percy right after Jasper.
Well, you know what happened was, so Peter and I have been married 26 years, together 27 years. And in all of our time together, in all those years, we've only been without a dog about 18 weeks of that. And part of the reason is because, and now we're on our third Vishla. And what happened when Jasper died, it was so shocking. I'm sorry, Henry died. He was my first dog. This is the dog that I had from, got him in Scotland when I was living with Peter in England. I was 26 years old. We moved to California. He was a surfing dog. He could surf with the best of them out by in the Navy SEALs beach in Coronado. He was amazing. And he could do everything. He knew all the names of all of his toys. We had this trick that I taught him. You know, they say you can't teach an old dog new tricks. I could teach him anything. And George Bush used to laugh so much because I taught Henry, I'd say, hey, Henry, show us what you think about John Kerry. And we would go to his toy box and get my old flip-flop and bring it back. And we'd be like, flip-flop, flip-flop. And he was the best. When he died, it was so shocking. We had just moved to New York. We're living in an apartment in the city. There's no grass anywhere. And we're like, he was almost 14, so it's not totally unexpected. And Greta Van Susteren called me around 10:30 p.m. that night. Who calls at 10:30 p.m., right? I thought somebody else had died. And she says, hi, I know you don't want to hear this, but you have to get another one right away. I said, well, Greta, I can't because we live in an apartment and now I have this new job. And it's like, how am I going to train him? And she goes, it's the only way to heal your heart. And then Charles Krauthammer said, I know you think, why do we do this to ourselves? Because the grief is so painful. And he says, because dogs make us better people. And so when Jasper died, one of our friends who is a breeder heard about this and called and said, I've got a litter coming. We said, we'll take the largest male.
It's so smart. I did the thing where like, well, I did two things. I can't replace him. And so I don't want to try. And then same as your story, I had moved to New York and I was like, I can't get a Doberman. You love Vishlas. Mm-hmm. I love Doberman. I was like, I can't get one in New York City. But what it ended up being is 10 years of my life without a dog. And you're right, it is less of a life. I really do believe that. But you and I are huge dog people. But it's less of a life. And now that I have another one, I realize what I was missing all that time.
Also, I'm sure you find with your family that it brings the family together.
Yes.
Even if the family's in an argument, like everybody can agree that the dog's the best.
But you made a mistake. I let the first dog in the bed because it was just me and him. She does not, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and act like a hard ass. She definitely gets in the bed. My wife is the weak link. Mm-hmm. But the rule is not in the bed.
Right.
Not in the
bed. Yeah, Percy does not have that rule at all. But he's a good dog. And I love also one of the great things about in this time where people might feel estranged from their fellow American. Like I find that you can always find common ground talking about your pets.
Yeah. And I think common ground is important. I used to talk about that in sports. I think we have to remember we have to remember that we are each human beings.
Yeah.
And that's what's been really lost, I think, is I think both societally and individually, Dan, I think like we've lost some of our even complexity as human beings, like acknowledging our failings, acknowledging the limitations of our own knowledge, acknowledging when we're wrong. We're just kind of losing what it is to be a person.
Yeah.
I want to go to part of your story that you already brought up. So we're talking about Kaylee, press secretary. So you mentioned it. You were living in England. I don't know your story that well, yep. but you know, I know you were born in Wyoming.
Yep.
You grew up in Denver.
Yep.
You end up working in politics. You worked at some congressional
Capitol
offices,
Hill. Mm-hmm.
And then you left. And then you left for England. And if I look at your life, it looks like it seems to me, on the surface at least, the thing that brought you back to not just America but to Washington D.C. was 9/11.
It's true. You got it exactly right. Yep, I met Peter on an airplane in August of 1997, moved to England in May of 1998. So a very quick romance and a decision to leave what I thought was like my career, that I would never work again in politics or television. Obviously, that's not true, and thankfully. But, you know, you tell yourself these things when you're making big decisions and you're young and your horizon ends here. When you realize, and actually your life is so much bigger than that. And I truly believe that the best advice I was ever given in my life was from a family friend who told me when I was wrestling, should I move to England or not? She said, do not give up on this chance to be loved. And it will not hurt your career. And boy, she was right. And thank goodness I listened to her. So we're living in England. Peter wants to start his own business. I want to get back to working. I didn't have a visa and we had gotten married. So we decided we're going to live in America and we could choose anywhere we wanted to live. So we chose San Diego because who wouldn't want to live there? And we moved there with literally nothing, $10,000 of borrowed money. We didn't have a car, an apartment, anything. We had a dog, puppy, Henry. And we moved to San Diego and we just tried to make a go of it there. And I was working in public relations, but I missed Washington, D.C. I wanted to work for George W. Bush. All my friends were working somewhere in the administration. And I just, I was felt like a square peg in a round hole in San Diego. And people in D.C. knew that I was willing to come back. I did some interviewing in August of 2001, mid-August 2001. And 9/11 happens, and I reach out to my friend at the Justice Department to say, are you all right? And she called me and said, would you be willing to come back still, even after all of this? I need another spokesperson that can join my team right away. And I started packing while we were on the phone and moved 2 weeks later. I think I moved like October 8th or 9th. That's what I remember coming into Washington, D.C. and the leaves were starting to turn on the trees. And I never went back to that house in San Diego. Peter stayed there, got it packed up, and that was really the moment. And I was just working at the Justice Department as one of many spokespeople. And I was assigned the Environment and Natural Resources Division, which is one of the reasons I'm really interested in energy and environment and conservation, kind of from where I grew up, but also just where I cut my teeth on policy.
Before we start talking about the life of a press secretary, how do you fall in love on a plane?
It was quick. And you know what? It happens more often than you think. It's unbelievable how many people have actually met on a plane. Now, this was 1997, so I had a hard copy book. I did not have AirPods. I didn't have I wasn't carrying around my Walkman. You know, I didn't have anything that would distract me. And, you know, you sit down. You're like, he asked me if he could put my bag up above for me. I heard the accent, but really it was because I think on a plane you kind of let down your guard. Like, I might not ever see this person again. So you can talk about anything. And he was funny. And I remember I asked him, what do people in Europe think about Bill Clinton? And his answer was perfect. And I said, okay, I remember looking out the window and saying, Lord, I know I asked you to help me find somebody, but he's much older than me. He might be an axe murderer. He lives in England. I don't know if anything he's saying is true, but how could it possibly be? And then we had our first date. He came back to America like 4 weeks later. And then we were engaged 2 weeks after that. I mean, it was quick and it has lasted.
That was one hell of an answer about Bill Clinton.
Great answer on Bill Clinton, Peter. You had no idea.
How does that work at the end of the flight? He asked for your number?
Well, actually, we were going to trade information. And I had just been in Denver doing editorial board meetings with the congressman I worked for. And I was out of cards. This is back in the day when you had like the hard copy business card. So he gave me one of his that we still have to this day. And I didn't want him to think that I was flirting with him. So I made the business card look like my business card. I even included the fax number and to make it look real official. That's how we exchanged information.
All right. Press secretary. From the outside, Dana, and I've told this to Kaylee. She's guest hosted on Fox and Friends Weekend, so I've had to have conversations.
Yeah, she does such a great job.
Yeah, and that's a nice time because you spend 4 hours together with commercial breaks and you can kind of get to know each other. But I've told Kaylee this. to me, from the outside, and I think for a lot of us, it looks like a really fun job, a stressful job. But for me, and maybe my personality type, it looks like a fun job. You look from a
You'd
lot
of, love it.
A lot of my career. Look, I was outnumbered at CNN, and I was outnumbered at ESPN. And I used to say, like, if you want to know a debate or rhetorical trick, like when you, if you're Jessica Tarlov sitting at the table on the five, you're outnumbered somewhat. Mm-hmm. 4-1. Mm-hmm. You don't have to rebut every single point. No. You can pick your favorite
pick one.
To rebut. You, as a press secretary, are surrounded, this is my characterization, but dozens of hostile, you know, questioners. And I'm just, it looks like it would be fun.
I loved that job with my entire being, mostly because I really loved and believed in the president I was working for and the purpose and the cause. We were a nation at war, and we took our jobs very seriously, but we didn't take ourselves seriously. I would not say that the most reporters in the room weren't hostile. I would say adversarial, but that was by nature. I think that's true. I always believed that 50% of my job was defending and representing the president of the United States, advocating for the policies and defending our country and on the world stage. But that the other 50% was making sure that the press had access to the government. And I took that very seriously. That has gone away. Do you know that that Joe Biden has not given one interview in the Oval Office to any of the main media from the briefing room, and that they don't complain about it? I cannot believe. They complain about it, but they're not up in arms about it. So I thought that things were adversarial. My power in the room was, one, I had the microphone. But also, I try always to be the most well-read person in the room, and I wanted all of them to know it. But I would also take an interest in what they were writing. So I would read everything that they wrote, and I would pay attention, and I would say, hey, Cheryl, that was a great piece this weekend that you wrote about something that maybe had nothing to do with the White House. I had good relationships with them, and I understood where they were coming from. I knew they had a job to do and that I had a job to do. So I never thought of it as hostile. Sometimes I would maybe be a little oversensitive at times to criticism, but I also operated under the never let them see you sweat. There's something also that's two major differences between when I was there and when somebody like Kaylee was there. It used to be that the briefing was started and ended with the lead wire reporter in the room, the most senior wire reporter in the room. I just accepted as tradition that you were not let off of the podium until that senior wire reporter said, thank you. Which meant, yes, like, talk about a challenge. Like, okay, I'll just sit here and take these questions. But also, if things got repetitive or ridiculous, the senior reporter would be like, okay, we're done here. Thank you. So that was one thing. Now you see, like, Corinne will, like, shut her binder and storm off as if it's something, you know, as if she's making a statement because she doesn't want to answer the questions anymore. But the other thing we did not have is social media. It was not a thing. When I left on January 20th, 2009, I didn't even have a Twitter account. And all of that has changed the job tremendously.
How does social media change the job?
Well, first of all, every reporter, you know exactly what they're saying. And a lot of, if you watch reporters, they all tweet for each other, trying to outdo one another. Not so much anymore. It has calmed down, I would say. But during those first years when Twitter was first taking off, you would all of a sudden, it was like, oh, the mask was off. You knew exactly where they were coming from. That changed a little bit. And they were competing for eyeballs from their bosses as well. The other thing is just, you know, the vitriol. Now, there was also great opportunity because, and you see President Obama, but mostly President Trump, really take advantage of this, that you don't have to wait to tell the American people at the briefing room what's on the president's mind. I'll tell you what's on the president's mind right now. And actually, President Trump said, I'll do you one better. I'll tell you what's on my mind directly. So the job of the press secretary, to me, has changed a tremendous amount. And Biden doesn't utilize those tools, but President Trump did, just like John F. Kennedy figured out how to use television, or Ronald Reagan using television, FDR using radio. Barack Obama figured out social media initially for the fundraising. In 2008, they had things like Cat Lovers for Obama. Would you give us $5 today? That's how the small donors really started. Like, he figured that out. Trump figures out how to use social media to his benefit or detriment to talk directly to the American people. So there's a next thing coming, and it might be TikTok. It might be something, I'm not exactly, maybe not TikTok, but some version of it that's coming, that there's always a way to think ahead about the innovation. And I wish that I had thought of that beforehand. I just didn't.
So you described your relationship with the press as adversarial but not hostile. And I don't think that she'll mind me saying this. I asked Kaylee about her relationship with the press.
That was hostile.
Yes, and she also said that it was at arm's length. There was not going out for drinks afterwards. Mm-hmm. There was not a personal connection to the press pool. Mm-hmm. Yours sounds like you had much more of a relationship, even if it were adversarial. But I am curious, not only has social media changed the game, of course, Donald Trump changes the game as well, and it becomes much more hostile on both sides towards the press. But I'm curious, with you now, like those same relationships who may have been cordial if adversarial have now exposed themselves on Twitter. Mm-hmm. You're now on Fox. Mm-hmm. What are those relationships like for you now?
I don't talk to that many of them anymore, but I'm still very friendly with them. Like Kelly O'Donnell of NBC News will always be fond of her. What's actually pretty interesting is John Roberts, who anchors our 1 to 3. He was at CBS when I was at the White House, CBS and then CNN. Brett Baer was at Fox. Obviously, a lot of people I'm now colleagues with. Kevin Cork was at NBC. A lot of people have moved around, right? So I'm now working with many people who were in the briefing room at the time. Several of them have left the job. Many of them have retired. I mean, it was 2008 when I left. So, and you think about it, I was in the White House from 2002 at some point, at some level, 2002 through 2008. That's a long time. I mean, careers have changed. There's different personalities now in the briefing room. Some have even passed away, like Bill Plant, for example, of CBS News. So we're still friendly. You talk about an arm's length. One of the things we used to do on foreign trips, I mean, we went a lot of places, Chief of Staff Josh Bolton, he would host the reporters for bowling. We went bowling in Peru, Romania, Moscow. A few other places are coming to mind. Like, that was our thing. Like, we took the reporters bowling. It was all off the record. And it was fun, friendly, and you get to know people a little bit more as to, like, their kids might love softball or, like, whatever it is. You have a little bit of that human connection that we're talking about beforehand, and that really helped, especially on days that were tough.
So I want to ask you this. I think this ties into your experience, not just as press secretary, but you have a wealth of experience in Washington, D.C., that someone like I would not have. And I think that you can help inform me, for example, on things that from the outside just remain so mysterious. So what I'm talking about is a lot that took place over the past week. So in Congress, at least two different bills have passed through the House that it would appear on the surface that is out of touch with the Republican voter base. That's the FISA renewal and the funding for Ukraine. Now, I look at that and I go, all right, Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House, is a guy that for many people would be thinking, that's a surprise. It's not who we thought Mike Johnson was necessarily before he became Speaker. And I think a lot of people on the right dismiss it as you've been co-opted by the establishment, or you've become the regime, or you've now become Washington, D.C. And it's easy to villainize everybody that disagrees with you. For me, I sit there and I go, well, what am I missing? Mm-hmm. Right. So I sit there and I still don't understand, Dana. I have trouble to this day understanding the importance to America of Ukraine. But clearly something with Mike Johnson and a great huge chunk of the Republican congressional offices feel differently than me. So I mean, you have access, you have experience in that world, and I don't want to be somebody that just dismisses it as, and I'm not saying it shouldn't be dismissed, but I don't want to just dismiss it as, well, you're now Washington D.C. So what do you think? Like, we could use those two bills as an example, but what do you think goes on and explains? And by the way, the base may not be out of touch. I mean, some of the base is, but polling on Ukraine is pretty, I don't know what it is today.
It's like 60%
support. 60% support. Yeah. So what is that what's going on? A calculation of polling?
I'm not sure. I do think things get distorted by a few people who are very loud. And I think that Mike Johnson, I'm going to take him at his word. He said, I listened to the briefings that he was giving the classified briefings, and he was convinced that this is an important thing to do and the right thing to do and the right thing for our own national security and our future. This is the right thing to do. He said he prayed about it, and he figured out a way to get it through. Now, he's dealing with the – I've never seen congressional majorities this small. I don't know, but I don't think that there was this really robust conversation on the Ukraine side. That's on the Ukraine side. On the FISA thing, on the FISA renewal, I did FISA renewal in 2007, 2008, and it was the same arguments back then. And it's been abused, and it's been modified, and then you have people that are on the Intel committees and listening, like Republicans who are saying, we're listening to these briefings. We believe that this is in our national security interest, and this is why we think we want to vote this way. Part of the thing with the media is that everything is so distorted, like how much information people can get. And it's like, I was talking this weekend about how, you know, when you're looking at a highway where the speed limit is 75, so people are going 85, and the cars are moving this fast. That's how fast some of these conversations are going. Mm. And the other day I interviewed a senator who I asked about FISA renewal. He said one of his big problems with it was about big tech being able to sell our information. And I said, is that in the 702 segment, the section that you're complaining about that you don't like? He says, absolutely it is. I said, oh, okay. I mean, I've not done it for a while, so I don't know. Well, 2 hours later, I found out, oh, I was right. So I'm like, even the senator and I are both like pretty educated people on this issue, and we're not quite nailing down the facts of it all. So I think people are not going to Washington like maybe they used to, but maybe they should.
What do you mean by that?
One of the things is that they don't know each other. Like I was just saying, like in the off the record bowling right. excursions that we would do once in a while, that just made looking at each other a little bit more as humans, as also people we have to work with. So back in the day, like when Harold Ford Jr. was a child and his father was a congressman, that was when there wasn't that types of communications that we have now. You moved your family to Washington, D.C. so that you could be there and do your job. And your kids went to school there and you bought a house there. And then you would go home for congressional recess. You didn't fly in on a Tuesday morning and leave first thing on a Thursday night. You actually were there. Everybody got to know each other. You would have dinners together. Harold Ford Jr., he might make a friend at school with somebody that you disagreed with vehemently on politics, but the kids are friends. And so, you know what? You end up having a beer in the backyard with your opponent and you had that kind of interaction. And I do think that for all of us, it's why I'm not for working from home, for people in the workplace, not just in politics. It's that human connection is critical for our own well-being, and work relationships make getting to a result better.
Yes, but I'm a little torn on that. I understand how that increases collegiality, mm-hmm. but I guess my concern would be, I don't want you, Congressman, connected to, I'm from Texas, I don't mm-hmm. want you, Texas Congressional District Congressman, to be connected to your either Democrat or Republican congressional colleague from Wisconsin. I want you to be connected to your district. Mm-hmm. And so go home and connect with your district, and you may accomplish some collegiality, but I think there's a concern for many people, but it increasingly just makes you more removed from the American people. And I guess that's what I've kind of, like in a way, that's what I'm asking you, like, because you have that exposure, and I own my humility on this, I do not have this exposure of having been in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. and been inside these institutions. And I am concerned. I do share many of the concerns that it's increasingly removed from America. And like you bring up Mike Johnson saying, I saw the Intel briefing. Mm-hmm. Well, I respect that. I also mm-hmm. worry that the institutions behind the intelligence communities, mm-hmm. yeah, can I trust them to mm-hmm. not pursue their own self-interest and co-opt congressmen who are now increasingly removed from the American voter base?
Mm-hmm. Well, Harold Ford and I gave a speech together the other day. And he and I looked at each other as we were giving our answers. And on stage, in front of everybody, I said, do we sound really old? Because what we're talking about no longer happens. And I don't think there's any going back. I think the horse has left the barn. Like, nobody is going, like, what you're saying is that they don't want to hang out with their congressional member from Wisconsin.
But even that, is it good, too? Is it good
Well, is it good
bad?
Now?
Would it be good for them to?
Do what we have now, is it good?
Well, so there's two sides to that. I'll give you my perspective on both sides. One, and it's we just talked about this last week here on the Will Cain Show. Justice Scalia gave this talk before Congress where he talked about what makes the United States exceptional. Mm-hmm. And he said it's not the Constitution. He said, you know, there are many different countries who've drafted wonderful constitutions, but you could have parchment guarantees. Like, just because you put the promises on paper doesn't mean it's how it manifests in life. He said what makes America special is its checks and balances, its bifurcated government, it's the three branches of government, all designed to create gridlock. He said, you American people need to learn to love gridlock because gridlock is the preservation of freedom. Mm-hmm. You know, good laws impose upon freedom. So I think in that way, it can be good now.
Yeah.
I think the flip side of that I'm saying is a problem is I do think it's a problem if congressmen think their job is simply to preen to the public. And I think there is a lot. And I've talked up the virtues of populism, not across the board, but populism is like an ingredient in a recipe. You need to be careful exactly how much you put into the recipe.
A dash.
But I do think we have gotten to a place today where congressmen are performing.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, another thing is, like, let's go back to the briefing room for a second. Mike McCurry was the press secretary for Bill Clinton in 1997. I don't know which ranges he was, but definitely I know it was 1997. And he made a decision that changed a lot of things for everybody, as did C-SPAN around the same time. What did they do? He allowed cameras into the White House briefing room for the first time ever. And what if all of a sudden did you have performance? Okay. What do you have on C-SPAN? Performance. Cable news, it's performance. And that's why I'm saying, like, I don't know if that's necessarily better. I like gridlock. Oh, I love it when they're Congress in recess. That means they're not raising my taxes or putting more regulation. But the problem is Biden's doing all the regulations. So now we're relying on the judicial branch in order to backstop all of that. And thank goodness from my perspective that's happening. But what has that done? That also means that on the opposite side, if you don't like what some of the Supreme Court decisions, then you think that institution's broken. And so they might trust the intel community, but they don't trust the Supreme Court. So I don't know if any of that's good. But the funny thing about Mike McCurry is the very day he let cameras into the briefing room was the day that the Monica Lewinsky story broke.
Oh, really? What a
day.
And
he said, what have I done?
All right, I want to ask you one last thing because I've always been fascinated by this part of your story, and you and I have talked off and on a little bit about this, but you've got to tell me just a little bit more about Wyoming. You've got to tell me about the family, the family ranch. You grew up. You're basically Beth from Yellowstone.
Oh, I don't know. I'm not that badass at all. I'm trying to think if there's another character in that story, but no, probably not. My great grandparents came from Italy separately. My great grandfather came to be a coal miner in Weston County. So that's the Black Hills of Wyoming. So about 80 miles west of Mount Rushmore. And there was a coal mine called the Cambria plant. I think it might still be there, actually. And a lot of Italians came over and they took advantage of the Homestead Act. This is the late 1800s. And the Homestead Act said you can get 60 acres as long as you promised to farm it for 5 years and you had to build a structure. It had to have two rooms and four walls. And you had to build a well. So my grandfather would work the 5.5 days. And on Saturday afternoon, he would walk the 18 miles and he would hand dig the well, come back. And he met my great grandmother at the boarding house. My great grandmother's sister ran the boarding house. They meet there. They fall in love. They have 9 children. One died as a child. One of them was my grandfather that lived, and he was going to be a doctor. And school was about 22 miles from where they were, so they would go to school. It was like a lot, right? This was really uphill both ways. And then he went to the war in World War II and thought that he was going to become a doctor and see the world. Came back from World War II and decided after being in the Pacific, he'd seen the world, enough of it, and the ranch really needed him to come back. On that night that he's going to arrive back in America, they're going to dock in Philadelphia. His friends say, we're going to set you up on a blind date. He says, absolutely not going. My grandmother, they said, we're going to set you up on this blind date. He says, absolutely not, I'm not going. They go on the blind date, and 2 months later, kind of like my story in a way, she moved to Wyoming. 2 months later, takes the train across, and my dad was the oldest of their three boys, and my grandfather grew it to a 50,000-acre ranch, and he passed away right 2 months after 9/11, the day after Thanksgiving, moving cattle, massive heart attack, and my uncle Matt runs the ranch now with his two sons, Wade and Preston, and their children. And it's a beautiful, wonderful place that my uncle says, don't tell anybody how nice it is. They don't want anybody else coming.
What? I've been there, not to your ranch, to that corner of Wyoming. What's the famous Devil's?
Devil's Tower. So it's about 80 miles, 50 miles south of Devil's Tower and 80 miles west of Mount Rushmore. So I grew up going to see the faces. You know, that was our big trip. Gonna go see the faces every year.
In Mount Rushmore. I am so jealous.
It was a beautiful childhood. I'll always be grateful that I had that opportunity, and I care very much for rural America. And I'm glad that Fox pays attention. We don't pay enough attention, but we pay more attention than anybody else.
I think that's right. Yeah. I think that's absolutely right.
I love the segment that you and Pete do about outside
off
the grid. I love that segment.
Thank you.
A great one.
Yeah, we need to be in touch not just with New York and Washington, D.C. We need to be in touch with America. And he and I are lucky enough that he lives in Nashville and I still get to live in Dallas. Texas. But I would prefer to live on a 50,000-acre ranch in Texas.
One day, you will.
All right, Dana Perino, thank you so much for hanging out with us today on The Will King
Show. Thanks so much.
All right, coming up, 5 things you need to know at the open of the trial against Donald Trump. That's coming up on The Will King Show.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network, subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and 4-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
All right, coming up, I've hit the bottom, not of the internet. I've hit the bottom of Netflix, Amazon Prime Video, Peacock, Paramount. I've hit the bottom of the streaming services offerings in video content. But I do have a new recommendation from Fox and Friends' Ainsley Earhart. Here's a tease. Naked Attraction. That's coming up on The Will Cain Show. Streaming live at foxnews.com on the Fox News YouTube channel. The Fox News Facebook page and always on demand at Apple, Spotify, or at Fox News Podcast. And you can subscribe to The Will Cain Show on YouTube. Today, opening statements in the New York quote-unquote hush money trial against Donald Trump. Wanted to walk you through what to expect over the next 4 to 6 weeks, what to pay attention to, the 5 things you need to know as we begin the trial against Donald Trump. Number 1, the charges. This begins with misdemeanor charges for fraudulent business transactions. The allegations are that Donald Trump wrote over $130,000 of checks to his attorney, Michael Cohen, as a funnel into $130,000 payments made over 34 different checks to porn star Stormy Daniels. 34 charges for the 34 checks written that total $130,000. Now, here's what you need to know about these would-be misdemeanor charges. First, these making a non-disclosure agreement, what is often termed hush money, is not in and of itself illegal. It happens all the time. It happens with Hollywood celebrities. It happens with Fortune 500 companies. And one could guess, it would be speculation, it's probably happened in the past, although it would be embarrassing and probably not something they would discuss, happened in the past with Donald Trump. It only becomes a criminal charge when it is recorded in your business transactions as something other than an NDA. In this case, the allegations by the prosecution is it was recorded as legal fees to Michael Cohen, hiding the nature of the payments. But the most important part of these misdemeanor charges is that the statute of limitations has run. These date back to 2016, 2015 and 16, and the statute of limitations has run its course. The statute of limitations is the amount of time a prosecutor has to bring a charge. They become expired at some point. Murder, for example, has no statute of limitations, but other criminal charges have to be filed by a prosecutor within a certain amount of time because memories get hazy. Interests become more suspicious. The reason to conduct a trial, less compelling. So you have to bring the charges within a legislated amount of time. It's 2 to 3 years for these particular misdemeanor charges, and they've long since passed their statute of limitations. Now that brings us to number two, the charges, the felonies. Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg has turned these misdemeanors into felony charges, which carry a longer statute of limitations. The statute of limitations on felony charges that you recorded false business transactions in pursuit of undermining federal election laws is a statute of limitations that has even been extended 1 year because of COVID. Now, in order to bootstrap himself into felony charges with a longer statute of limitations, Alvin Bragg had to find a felony underneath, a criminal conspiracy underneath the misdemeanors to make them felonies. If you recorded fraudulent business transactions in pursuit of another crime, they become a felony. And the allegation here, the crime here, is election interference. So here's how that works. The argument goes that Donald Trump, even if my speculation earlier is right, that he perhaps had constructed similar deals in his past. We don't know that to be true, but if he had, it would undercut the idea that he did it in this case to influence a campaign. Bragg is suggesting he did it to influence the 2016 presidential election, that he paid Stormy Daniels money to hide that story from coming out. Now, here's the trick to this being an election fraud case felony. The Federal Elections Commission has already taken a look at this case and decided, no, it is not worthy of prosecution. The Department of Justice, who maintains jurisdiction over federal crimes like election interference, has looked at this case and said, no, it's not worthy of prosecution. But going outside of his jurisdiction, and in order to extend his statute of limitations, Bragg is attempting to make the case that these payments to Stormy Daniels were or should have been marked down as campaign contributions to Donald Trump in his pursuit of the presidency in 2016. Again, the FEC, no. The DOJ, no. The Manhattan District Attorney, yes. Point number three to know over the next 4 to 6 weeks of this case against Donald Trump, the testimony. The two most important players in this trial will be former Trump attorney Michael Cohen and Donald Trump. You see, Donald Trump doesn't just deny that he did this in pursuit of the presidency. He denies he did it altogether. He denies that he paid money under the guise of an NDA, or more salaciously, hush money, to Stormy Daniels. Daniels, for her sake, by the way, has gone back and forth on that. She has given testimony both ways as to whether or not she received payments of Donald Trump to keep quiet. It's going to come down to Donald Trump against Michael Cohen. Michael Cohen will get on the stand and say, this was the deal that was made with Donald Trump. I would pay Stormy Daniels and he would reimburse me through the guise of legal fees. And that's how we would fraudulently conduct business to hide this story in pursuit of the presidency. But here's the trick. Michael Cohen is a liar. He's a self-admitted liar. He has been convicted of perjury. He's lied in front of Congress. He's lied in court. He's lied publicly. He's lied over and over. He's not someone who, sitting in a courtroom, can be granted even a semblance of credibility. And you will take that against perhaps the testimony, but certainly the position of the defense for Donald Trump, who says, no, this did not happen. That is not the deal that I had with Michael Cohen. The other testimony that you will hear today and into tomorrow, most likely, is the publisher of National Enquirer, David Pecker, who will testify that Trump had a deal with the National Enquirer to conduct what's called a catch and kill scheme. Again, not illegal unless evidence of a wider conspiracy to affect an election. A catch and kill scheme is a technique among certain journalistic outlets to pay money for a story, exclusive rights to a story, and then kill the story, never publish it, thus making it go away. But whether or not Pecker establishes there's some type of background to that type of scheme with Donald Trump, it's still going to come down to the veracity of Donald Trump versus Michael Cohen, taking you to number four, the jury. The most interesting thing to note at the outset of this trial about the jury is it has sitting on its panel two lawyers. Now, most people, most trial attorneys would never, ever allow a lawyer to sit on the jury. Here's why. They become super jurors. They take over the room. We've talked here on The Will Cain Show how one juror can sway all other 11 in the jury box. And you know who's going to be most likely to do so? A lawyer. Now, you've got two lawyers, and they were allowed to remain on the jury with somewhat, at least, the consent of the prosecution and the defense. Now, the most likely reason for that is that in the end, the Trump team will try to impress upon these lawyers that regardless of the facts, this is a misapplication of the law. Now, I have no doubt that lawyers in New York City are the same as the greater voting base of New York City, 85% Democrat, 85% for Joe Biden. But it's an interesting gamble to say, yes, but at the end of the day, you are informed, you are a lawyer, and you should very least know better about the application of the law. Because if not, it takes you to number five to know about this trial, the outcome. The outcome of this trial is not about justice. It will not be about what is the end result of this once every appeal is registered. It is about what you can get a jury to say at the end of 4 to 6 weeks. And the gamble is that Bragg can get a jury that is 85% Democrat to say at the end of this, regardless of the application of the law, convicted felon Donald Trump. It will most likely not survive appeal. And if it survives an appeal in New York City or an appeal in New York State, it doesn't survive an appeal to the United States Supreme Court. That is almost guaranteed because it's that weak of a case legally. But it's not a case about the law. It's a case about politics. And the win in politics is, quote unquote, convicted felon Donald Trump. That is something they hope not that will survive appeal, but that will survive until November. That is what you can expect. Those five things are what to watch for over the next 4 to 6 weeks in the trial against Donald Trump. All right, coming up. Can we take a quiz to guess the audience score of various movies on Rotten Tomatoes? And does that lead me to a place where maybe there's something left to watch on the internet? That's coming up on The Will Cain Show. I'm so worn out, mad at myself. Like, I can't tell you how many times over the past couple of weeks I've said, why did you just spend time watching that? And I'm not talking about Love is Blind. That was time well spent. But I'm talking about any of the other movies that I've watched on Netflix or Prime. I've hit the bottom, man. I've hit the bottom. There's nothing left to watch. It's The Will Cain Show, streaming live at foxnews.com, the Fox News YouTube channel, and the Fox News Facebook page. Hit subscribe right now on YouTube, and you can watch every future episode live or catch up with interviews, monologues from past episodes of The Will Cain Show. Just hit subscribe on YouTube or on Apple or on Spotify. Guys, I mean, I'm in New York City today, which means I've spent the last couple of days in a hotel room. And when I'm in New York, I watch way too much. I don't even know. It's not even junk. I'm just like, why did I spend 2 hours doing that? Is nothing good.
I agree. I'm the same way. Good to have you here, by the way.
Thank you.
In New York. Love to see you in person. But I'm the same way. I was this weekend, I was literally watching as much as I could trying to find something, and I felt like I hit the bottom.
And I'm not proud.
No.
I'm not proud, and I said to myself, Will, read a book. Like, there's nothing left to watch. Now, I will tell you, this morning on Fox and Friends, Ansley Earhart said, I've got something for you to watch. I said, okay. Listen, I'm going to sell you guys on this show, okay? She said, it's British. All right. It's a, you guys know how I love human experimentation shows. Like, I love anything that kind of, like, makes us reveal our own psychology. That's why I like Love is Blind. And Lawrence Jones told me I need to watch The Circle, which is a reality show on Netflix.
I watched that one.
Is it good?
It's terrible, but fine. Yeah, it's good.
Is it a human experiment type thing?
Absolutely. To the most extent it could be.
Oh, I'm in on that.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Well, listen to this. She sells me on a show called, I think it's called Naked Attraction. Here's how it works. They do a lineup, like a police lineup of people. Do you already know?
Yeah, I've seen a trailer.
Really?
Yeah.
They do a lineup of people, like five people. And it's like, I'm here, and it'd be five women, and they raise a curtain or a wall, and I get to see their feet, right? And I start making comments. And then it goes a little higher up to the knees, and I take in the calves, and I make some judgments, right? And I haven't seen this. This is how it was sold to me. And then it goes all the way, it goes up. And I mean, now let's say it's a woman judging dudes, right?
Very important. You're
waist high, okay? Now you're waist high and you're judged waist down.
Where have we gotten to in society? My goodness.
Are you not curious? Are you not entertained? And then they keep going. But I don't know. I guess the payoff has got to be at some point they reveal the face. So you make all these judgments and then...
Right.
And then, of course, you know, personality.
What about their personality, Will?
Yeah,
I was just going to say, like, that's where you should start with.
But tell me... You're not in on that pitch. That's an elevator pitch, and I'm like, tell me more.
Yeah, you know that, like, that boardroom where they're deciding shows like that, they're like, that's a great idea. Let's do that. Naked people, let's go.
It's kind of a reverse dating game.
Yeah. Which could work, I guess.
Yeah, reverse dating game, but you just incrementally let them see the person.
I really like that person's kneecaps. I'm in. I like him.
That's what people are talking about, kneecaps.
I was trying to be PG over here.
All right, if Naked Attraction is not for you, we've got to get to see if there's anything left as we scrape the bottom of the streaming internet. So, Tinfoil Pat tried to pitch us on this, like, Rotten Tomatoes alt site, of course.
which I've never heard of.
Yeah, right. It's
I just like to get on the ground floor, you know.
Yeah. Nice haircut, by the way.
Yeah.
Again.
He softened it.
Yeah, he did. Softened that hard line.
Last week there was more of a hard part. Last week he was more alt-right. Today he's a little more. He moved the part to the middle and used a little less product.
Yeah.
It's much more approachable. So you've got some Rotten Tomato scores. We're going to see if we can guess these things to see if it's something that we should watch.
Yeah, well, audience only, because there's a big discrepancy between audience and critics. So,
Let me just put this out there, Patrick. So I took screenshots of them. So I have the both reviews. So I have the audience and the critic score next to each other.
All right.
But we'll go with the one that's on the right.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, how's this going to work? You're going to ask me the movie, and I'm going to try to guess the score?
Yes. And we're also going to have the audience hopefully play along in the chat. So if you guys are listening in the chat, try to guess what you think the score will be.
And we're watching you in the chat always.
Yeah.
We have our eyes on you, just so you know.
Just like the people to Reddit.
Yeah, in Reddit. By the way, I like how people in Reddit are like, they're secretly watching us at all times now. All right, what do you got, Patrick?
All right, so let's go with the first one. Godzilla vs. Kong, The New Empire.
I mean, I scraped the bottom, but I haven't watched Godzilla. Well, maybe I saw one of the Godzillas. I have to admit. I just can't remember if it was Godzilla versus...
This is the newest one.
Oh.
It's the newest one.
Yeah. 5 years back, I saw some Godzilla. I thought he was versus somebody.
That's what I thought. I was very confused when my son told me there was another one that was out. I'm like, they just made this one 3 years ago. Apparently, there's another one because they can't stop recycling movies. So
audience score for Godzilla versus Kong. The funny thing is, I don't think the audience does much middle ground. They're like the Bible. They're like, you know, you're don't be lukewarm. You know, I'll spit you out. They go hot in the 80s, 90s, or they go cold in the 20s, 30s. So I'm tempted to go 60s. I think the audience likes Godzilla versus Kong. It's positive.
Someone in the chat said 33%, they think.
No. I'm going 72%. A little lukewarm.
Should I release the...
Go ahead.
That'd be 91%.
I knew it was going to be high. The audience loves it.
They love that one. I love the audience score. I don't look at the critic score anymore. I just look at the audience score.
You trust this. You're gonna see Godzilla versus Kong.
I will. All right. Absolutely.
It's true populism.
What do we got next?
So next we have the new Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. It appears to be a trend about regarding empires in Hollywood right now.
They love that
one. So this is the newest Ghostbusters. I believe some of the other Ghostbusters returned from the original movie. So no lady Ghostbusters in this one.
The Rotten Tomato audience likes to have a good time.
Mm-hmm.
And if I might, as much as I appreciate, and I like the Rotten Tomatoes audience score over the critic score. I do. But I don't dismiss the critic score. I factor it in. I think the audience sometimes can go for some things that I would find unfulfilling. So, like, I'm not sold on Godzilla versus Kong. I watched Roadhouse recently, and I watched it with the fam. And because we did it, we sat outside, always a smart choice. If you got good weather, you know, sit outside, watch it. It was not a waste of 2 hours. But if I'd watched Roadhouse by myself in a hotel room, I would have felt like I just drank 3 bottles of Jack Daniels, did, you know, 4 lines of Coke, and I was on the come down
well,
here.
We'll get to Roadhouse.
And hate myself. Yeah. I'd hate myself for spending 2 hours watching Roadhouse in a hotel room by myself. And so I'm a little skeptical of the audience sometimes, because I'll bet you Roadhouse is way up there. I bet you Roadhouse is.
I'm giving you nothing with my face right now.
Okay. I've been talking so much, I even forgot the movie we were reviewing.
Ghostbusters Frozen
new
Empire.
New Ghostbusters.
Oh, I think the audience is really going to like it. It's new. It's popcorn. They like that kind of stuff that I might sometimes find unfulfilling. So I'm going to say the audience is at 88% on this Ghostbusters.
And some people in chat are saying, someone said 42%, someone said 70%, someone said 60%. So this is the new Ghostbusters.
Greg Walker gave it a 3.
Wow.
A 3?
What is it?
We see you, Greg.
Will's the closest.
Oh, 83%.
83%.
He's starting to understand, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I like
you know the people. You're in tune with the people, Will.
I'm
a populist.
Yeah. Man of the people.
Yeah, you're the man of the people.
Yeah.
All right, what do we got next?
The will of the people. Our next movie is one you just talked about. It's 2024's Roadhouse.
Okay, all right.
So I figured we need to see, you know, what
so
is the audience, does the audience agree with you?
It was
what
so
what's
bad.
Going on?
It's not so bad.
It's so, Conor McGregor walked around like this the whole time.
I loved it.
Smiling.
You have to lean in. It knew it was stupid. There was a scene where Jake Gyllenhaal, I don't know, spoiler, I'm sorry about the spoilers. He ran a dinghy into a boat at full speed, head-on collision, but he jumped out just in time. Listen to me now. He jumped out just in time and bailed into the back seat of the boat. It was amazing.
It's incredibly realistic.
And at that point, I said to my wife, this is awesome.
Yeah.
Like, you have to lean in on the silliness of it. Jake Gyllenhaal, by the way.
Real quick, did you like Con Air?
Con Air?
Yeah.
Love Con Air.
Yeah.
Okay, I love Con Air. We just watched Con Air a couple weeks ago, and I'm like, all in on it.
We got some guesses in the chat for Roadhouse. You want me to throw them out there?
Yeah, let's do it. I already know where I'm going to go.
All right, we got a 90%, 58%, and 270%.
It's higher than 70. The audience is going to love this movie. They're going to love it. And by the way, Jake Gyllenhaal, Conor McGregor, too. They're jacked as all get out.
Yeah, I heard Jake Gyllenhaal put on like 20 pounds of muscle for that movie or something like that.
Yeah.
Crazy.
I'm going 90. Well, you got to leave a little room for some prestige films. So I will go 91%.
You know, this is funny because this is the closest one to the critics.
Yeah.
Within 7%.
You think the audience
53%.
I think the audience will sometimes hold remakes against them, like they liked the first one.
Yeah.
But Ghostbusters, maybe they've remade Ghostbusters so many times that it doesn't suffer from being compared to the first Ghostbusters. I bet you the audience is holding this against the first Roadhouse.
And I did the thing. Did you have person you watched with watch the old one too?
No.
Because my fiance had never watched the old one. So we watched the new one first. She's like, this is terrible. And then we watched the first one. I'm like, you'll get it. You'll get it. The first one you get. She's like, this is even worse. The old one.
That's the other thing I was forgiving of this, because you've just forgotten. The old Roadhouse is campy.
Yeah.
It's very campy.
Yeah.
And I don't think it would hold up for my boys.
Exactly.
So there's another theme on these movies. They're all remakes of other movies. So, or remakes, or you know, continuations of those films. So our next movie is actually an older movie, The Parent Trap, 1998, with Lindsay Lohan.
Oh,
I'd like to throw you off a little bit.
But I'm doing the '98 movie.
Yeah, you're doing the '98 version, not the Haley Mills with, 1950s version
with the younger Lindsay Lohan.
Yeah, I never saw this.
You never saw this. It's a classic, like Disney. I think it's a Disney movie. It's a classic.
Yeah, it's a Disney movie.
I was in my 20s.
Dennis Quaid.
I wasn't going to go see a Disney like parent family movie at that point in your life. You're just not going to do that. So I've never seen it. Audience, it's high though, because I mean I've heard of it, and it was a Lindsay Lohan heyday, right?
Yeah. Yep.
So
she played a twin of herself.
She was pretty normal.
I'm going
81%.
81%. Uh-oh. That's at 70%.
Okay.
The audience. But this is where the critics gave it 87%, much higher. So it's kind of confusing. I mean, it's a classic, but...
You're saying this version is a classic?
Yeah. For like kids my age, like millennials my age. Like 1998, I was 10. You know, it's a classic for our age.
It wasn't a bad little film.
I know a lot of people who will call it their favorite movie.
Really?
Mostly girls.
Mostly girls are.
Yeah, mostly girls.
I forget this movie exists.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yep.
All right. One more?
Yep. One more.
The last one. Tim Burton's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. This is the one with Johnny Depp playing Willy Wonka.
Yeah.
Oh.
So it's a little slightly older.
Even though that terrible abomination just came out with Timothy Chalamet.
I saw that.
Right. Ugh. I could have used that one, but no. I decided...
I don't think the Johnny Depp one's going to do well. I think he was creepy for mass audiences, and I think it was it is the remake from the famous Gene Wilder version, right? So I bet it's low. I'm going to go like 32%.
People in chat are saying 50%. Some said 80%, and it is?
Whoever said 50%.
51%.
Nice work.
Audience score, 83%. With the critic score, though, which is wrong.
I feel good about my finger on the pulse of America. Roadhouse was my big one that we missed on.
Probably a lot of tens and zeros mixed into this one.
Yeah, for sure.
Really creepy.
So are we going to watch Naked in a Naked Attraction?
Yeah, as a group?
I think we should do that as a show. And
we'll just live stream it.
And have a review. I have no idea where it is. I don't know where you watch it.
I have no idea.
I have a website. You can get all the shows.
You might need a website. Yeah.
James has some website.
Well, let's do it. Maybe I'll do the circle. But Naked Attraction deserves a viewing and a show breakdown. I think so.
Homework assignment.
Tinfoil Pat.
I'm going to see if I have the streaming platform now.
Well, let's not do it live on air.
No, we're not going to do it.
To go home and tell everyone my boss assigned me to watch naked people on a show.
We got like three roommates, you know?
Oh, it's on Max.
20-something-year-old dudes.
Yeah, like, probably.
Guys, I've got something for you. They're going to love it. All right. That's going to do it for us today here on The Will Cain Show. Hit subscribe, Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. Tomorrow, David Sachs, tech investor, huge, outspoken guy. Against the war in Ukraine. Be a fascinating conversation with David Sachs right here tomorrow on The Will Cain Show.
I'm Charles Payne. Listen to my Unstoppable Prosperity podcast so I can get you making money right now. Whether stocks are hitting new all-time highs or in free-fall mode, opportunities abound. So why are so many potential investors still sitting on the sidelines? In a new season of my podcast, I'm going to get you in the game. After 38 years on Wall Street, I'm ready to impart some lessons and get you invested in the greatest wealth-generating machine in history. Listen anytime, everywhere at foxbusinesspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.